So Tom talked about the computational work and kind of the fundamental work, and then the flight test. In between there is a lot of the wind tunnel testing. Our supersonic facility that at Glenn have been instrumental in that. Janet, you can tell us more.
Yeah, I probably should have gone in between guys on that. But yeah, so we have a little bit larger test section. We use the 8x6 wind tunnel test section. You mentioned the supersonic one. And we were able to, we were testing something more like this, where we had the engines on top and in the aft end, testing boundary layer ingestion to test for added efficiencies there. Then very quickly, we were dismantling all that in December, and we reconfigured then to test the low boom model here. So in February, we're up and running and testing this model in that wind tunnel, and we tested, and we had 250 or so test hours in that test section, and we finished in May and got enough data where we could change out the nose, we could change out portions of the wing and the tail to test all these different parameters that the gentlemen were talking about, and to find the optimum design now that would reduce the boom the most. And so all those tests have been complete now as of May. And now we've torn apart the whole place, and we're reconfiguring that that wind tunnel now to be the 9x15 section that's on the other side, uses the same general fans and motors and everything. We're tearing that apart and making it the most quiet test section for lower speed tests in the future. So in another year or so, we've got a lot of people that are waiting to test the quieter engines that are coming in the future. So it's a really busy place, and a lot of these other folks have wind tunnels as well, and all of them are kept very busy by our customers who are developing more and more advanced, quieter and faster engines and more energy efficient engines. So we are, very busy all the time.
Great. Yeah. So Dave, I'm gonna ask you. This is kind of like asking someone to describe a smell. But I'm sure we're trying to. How quiet is quiet, right? Because if anybody out here has ever experienced a sonic boom from a military aircraft or the shuttle, it's pretty. It'll get your attention. It will scare you. It'll scare your livestock, and it'll damage property in cases. Can you give us some sense of the magnitude?
And, I think Dave talked about it. And so we've done a lot of simulations. We said, part of it is understanding the human's response to what's objectionable, how much annoyance, what does it really sound like. So we've done a lot of simulations in our acoustics lab. It's really kind of down to the point of kind of like a very low kind of rumble in the background. We actually have a little chamber where we go, put subjects in, ask them a series of questions, give them a normal sonic boom, and then the simulated reduced sonic boom. I've actually been in the chamber. It's pretty cool. You really hardly notice it. It is just like some distant thunder that you might hear. And so it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So that would really be, I would think, to most people, not objectionable. It's kind of in the background noise of what we hear in nature, right?
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
As David said, the next step is getting out flying it. So we do these things in the lab. That's what's so kind of exciting about this whole new aviation horizons. We've been working these things, as Tom said, for decades. And the wind tunnel test, the computational models, but getting out flying it is really what makes this all come together.
Great. Hey, this has been really a great discussion. And before we go on, let me just ask you to help us thank our panelists. It's been just wonderful participation, guys.
Thank you. Thank you.
So if you can't tell, we're pretty enthusiastic, pretty passionate about what we do. And as I said, this is the greatest job in the world. I'm sure I speak for everybody here. And we work for you. We want to make sure what we're doing is impacting across the community and having benefit to everyone. So we want to hear from you guys. We have a few minutes, I think. And I think we've got maybe some mics in the audience. If anybody's got a question, and on these topics or anything we can answer, particularly in the area of aeronautics, aviation, what NASA's doing.
While we're getting to the other one, I've got one. They keep saying that for every dollar that's spent on NASA, we get about $8 back. I've always thought we should gather all the people that worked on the Mars rover and clone them. I'm sure there's some projects that you've done that even exceeded your expectations that we haven't maybe noticed as much? Do any come to mind?
Well, everything we've talked about and you saw in the video, digital fly-by-wire, winglets, composites, you know, a lot of that is routine now, but a lot of that started at NASA and NACA before that.
But nothing that maybe we haven't heard of or didn't get as much notoriety that gave you so much data that exceeded even what you thought you'd get. Nothing that's, I know it's hard to surprise you people, but
yeah.
I had a guess like, So I had a PhD thesis, which I didn't really think would really amount to much. I just wanted to graduate. But we did something called pressure-indicating paint or pressure-sensitive paint. We were the first ones to demonstrate it. I was at the University of Washington at the time, and we demonstrated at Ames in a small test section for the very first time. I did it, honestly, just I wanted to graduate, I wanted to get a PhD, and then I wanted to apply to the astronaut program. I went into the astronaut program and never realized what happened to that technology, and it actually grew and is used widespread at NASA in many different areas, and it helps design a lot of these models that you see. It helps you not have to draw the pressure taps on all the surfaces of the aircraft. You can just do a coating on the aircraft, and it really has made a big difference, and I really had no idea it would make such a difference when I started working on it.
One thing I'll mention that I, as a pilot, I find fascinating is that a lot of the work that we did in synthetic vision, a lot of the electronics in the cockpit that we intended, really, we were thinking was for high-end applications, military, NASA and the shuttle and so on. And now I've got an iPad and a ForeFlight and, you know, ADS-B in the cockpit. And I'm always marveling when I fly up here on a commercial airline and I have better data in my little Grumman on my iPad than they've got in the cockpit. So the intersection of those two sort of different technology areas has really proliferated stuff in a way we didn't anticipate, frankly. We knew how good the technology was. We didn't anticipate it would be available so widely.